everyone. Welcome to Conversations Around Conversations about the conversations we just had on the Clubhouse app earlier today. I'm Jess Ryan, CEO and co-founder of Broadway Unlocked. I have lived my whole life in the theater as an actor, a director, and a producer who then found technology and started combining the two.
And I'm Joe, co-founder of Broadway Unlocked. I try to bring a tech and media perspective to these conversations. This is Tech Theater, Clubhouse Conversations. It's a podcast to continue our conversation, because every week on Clubhouse, Tuesday, 12:55 p.m. Eastern, come on and join us, we have these amazing discussions with brilliant people who sit at the intersection of tech and theater.
And we always walk away from these Clubhouse talks with so many thoughts we didn't even get to, because, you know, we can only do so much talking and thinking in an hour. So we decided to share those thoughts, ideas that were sparked, and reach even more of our friends and collaborators. And so with that, welcome to Tech Theater Tuesday. And it seems like a great moment to just stop for a second and say hi to everyone who's a new listener. We've been doing this for a while now, which is pretty exciting. And I know you just said, Joe, that you try to bring a tech and media perspective to the conversation. But I would love for you to say hi to anyone who's new around these parts and let them know why you're qualified to do that.
Hi, everyone. So glad you decided to download today and you are listening to us here right now. As Jess alluded to, my history, my background is in the tech and the media space. I've spent over 10 years building, growing, and operating startup companies from Blip TV to Maker Studios to Mic Network. It's been a very fun ride, and I'm so excited to be paired up with Jess to be sitting now at this intersection of technology and theater.
Yeah, it's funny, when we met, and we met through another startup called Lunch Club, if you don't know that story, we were like, wait, we're kind of the inverses of each other, right? Like, I come from the arts, so it's the only thing I've ever done with my life, but I have this huge understanding, appreciation, and dare I say obsession with the ways in which technology can help make art more relevant and, you know, more widespread. And you, Joe, are sort of like the inverse of that, or at least I don't know if you considered yourself the inverse of that before we met, but I think you certainly are, having worked with you for a while now.
I don't know if I considered myself before, but, you know, like coming out of a good therapy session, my perspective, my mind, my world set was changed after meeting you.
I'm going to just go ahead and wager it wasn't me. It's all of the amazing organizations and brands we've worked with and all of the incredible people on our team and all of the wackadoodle theater people that are around all the time. But thanks for the compliment. That was very nice. Cool. So yeah, hi, welcome. We do this quick podcast every week, really, truly, because of what we said in the intro. We just like found ourselves continuously talking about the Clubhouse conversations afterwards up here in our office. So we made a podcast. This week on Clubhouse, it was kind of a fun off week, because we kind of stuck on one topic that then covered a whole bunch of ground. Lucy, our amazing producer, you want to say hi, Lucy?
Hello, podcast audience.
It's like a cast of thousands today. Lucy, our incredible Clubhouse producer, you know, each week chooses a bunch of news that's hit that surrounds technology and the theater or arts industries. And we chat about it in Clubhouse. And today, what was on all of our minds, I think, was the first early closing of a Broadway play in this very tenuous time, coming back from COVID and unsureness about audiences and safety and tourism and all that good stuff. So we just had like our first two casualties, actually, of the fall post-COVID Broadway season that announced closing 2 months, I think, ahead of when they were meant to close, which is sad face. So we got talking about that, and that led us into ticket buying trends, and that led us into audiences and diversity, and that led us into accommodations of privilege, and that led us into data collection. So y'all, it was a good conversation today. And again, if you're new, very frequently Joe is pretty quiet on our Clubhouse conversations, because I think, if I'm not misrepresenting you, you know, you're doing a lot of listening often, because a lot of this revolves around like insider theatery stuff. So my favorite thing to do on the podcast is ask Joe where he wants to start when we talk post Clubhouse. So I'm going to swing it over to you.
Let's do it. And I do love the sort of cadence we've gotten into with how Clubhouse goes and then how this podcast sort of builds out of that. Because I do normally spend the first part of our Clubhouse shows playing catch up and whether that be reading the article that we are talking about, whether it be looking into supplemental materials to help shape a question or a thought, or straight up just jumping into the conversation and be like, hi, I'm dumb. Can someone just explain how this actually works from all of these people who have lived in the theater for their whole lives, as Jess said. Also, quick sidebar, when you said, I live in the theater, I was like, oh, this is a fundraiser to help Jess get an apartment. Like, welcome everyone. She currently lives in the theater. Well, I actually was in league with how I approach all of these conversations. We didn't actually get too much into like the substance of, what is happening in the Broadway world right now in terms of these two shows that are closing down. Mm. You know, this article itself talks a lot about how the ticket buying habits of arts patrons have changed from the pre-pandemic times and haven't either rebounded to the same just global level of ticket purchasing, but also just like the metrics that I think a lot of these houses use to like kind of scope out what their run is going to look like. Just like they don't play anymore because of the changes in the behaviors of arts patrons and theater goers. You know, the one stat that I my head sticks in that I love, and it just makes me think about these poor humans who have all these models that they use to decide whether or not a show is going to be successful that just kind of don't really work in the same way anymore. Mm-hmm. Specifically, when are tickets being purchased and how there used to be this built-in demand and this built-in cycle of people purchasing tickets 6-8 weeks in advance. Those would be leading indicators of certain points of success. And those data points are just, they don't exist anymore. And most people are purchasing only a week or two out, which makes sense for anyone who is currently alive and has lived through the pandemic. You understand that your own decision-making has changed and everything feels a little bit more tenuous. And so, yeah, I totally empathize with, you know, patrons who just are like, well, I'm going to wait a few weeks before I buy that ticket, whether it be a plane ticket to New York or a theater ticket when I'm there. Yeah, with the impact that that has, because, you know, these Broadway houses and these shows that have gone up, they've only been up for a few weeks. They don't have a new wealth of data to, from which to make decisions and to learn and understand, oh, people not buying 6 weeks early doesn't mean that the run is totally fucked. It just means people aren't buying 6 weeks early anymore. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious to see where that data starts to go and what new models are born of this new era. Because a model is just meant to capture and predict. It's to capture data that you have in an effort to predict what the future is going to look like. And the data has changed. And so now the model needs to adjust with it.
Yeah. I mean, that's, I can only see opportunity in this. Not to say there isn't a lot that is really hard about the moment. So that I'm not saying there isn't, of course there is, but like my brain can only really see the opportunity that comes with all of this. It's like so exciting because things have to change, right? And as we talk about frequently in Clubhouse and on this podcast, like there's a lot of stuff that needs to change, in my humble opinion, and many other people's, right? With the commercial theater industry in particular. And this is like a pretty cool moment. Also, when you were speaking about all the statistics in the article that we read, which, by the way, is up on Twitter. We always put those on our Twitter account, which is at BWY Unlocked. You know, Lucy had mentioned, you mentioned that one of those statistics was that the buyers are younger and from a lower income bracket than previous to the pandemic. And one another thing we didn't talk about in Clubhouse, but that we talk about all the time, and I can't believe it hasn't been brought up yet, is like, why is that? The thing we scream all the time. There is significant research that suggests adults who interact with technology around the arts are twice as likely to come to a show. And what happened last year? Tons of people who probably had never been to a theater show in New York, in their communities, wherever, whatever, you know, you want to draw. And I would be really interested to see data on that too, interacted with theater online. And now we have a younger subset of people who are not normal ticket buyers buying tickets.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I'd be so curious to see that research of like how big of a component is that what you're speaking of and how much can be attributed to people who hadn't been engaging with the arts at all, engaging digitally, and then entering that pipeline to actually seeing something live and in person, which is just like so cool to think about, like a theory that we had posited for a long time actually coming true and coming through in the data on the biggest stage in the game, Broadway.
We should reach out proactively to the NEA and find out if they're doing research on that right now. And have someone on because they're the ones who did this report.
For our new audience members who don't know what the NEA is.
Oh, sorry.
Not me. I know what they are. I definitely know what the NEA is.
Is the National Endowment for the Arts, right? Which I'm going to misquote this, but is like one of the most significant granting institutions for arts in the country. And they're also a huge source of kind of the only data that exists in the theater industry. There's not a lot of data. So the National Endowment for the Arts they have a division that is, I can't remember what it's called, but it's devoted to technology and the arts. And they did a couple of reports. And I really hope they're working on this right in this moment. And like, certainly we should have someone on, like, this is such an important moment in what all of us do.
Yeah, I'm sure they're feeling the pressure and the importance of it all. That, and I do want to, you know, just a shout out to the NEA and the NEAs of the world, the companies that do this research and collect this data so that the rest of us can make decisions.
Yeah.
And make informed decisions or write articles about it. Because I had that thought across this article that we're now talking about. I think it was NYC and Company that was cited for a number of stats just about tourism and the mm-hmm. sort of resurgence of tourism in New York City specifically. And I was just like, what would we do without these organizations actually collecting this information and making estimates and helping us to, yeah, make decisions or even simply just write articles explaining what's happening?
Well, I can tell you what we do. We have no idea what we do, i.e. the Broadway League not reporting the grosses. And we have no idea what's actually happening inside these commercial theaters, right? Like,
I'm just going to assume that everyone's doing great.
Clearly not. If we already lost two plays.
Wait, which two shows is it that?
They're two that are running in rep. So it's This Is a Play and Dana H. And they're actually, so they're two different plays by different playwrights and different directors, different producing teams, I believe. And they're in the same theater in repertory, which means they switch on and off nights. I don't know how they're chunking that out, but I think this is the first time in my time in New York City that this has been done, I believe. I don't know, you know, in all of history, but that's like not a usual thing.
Oh, the switching of nights is not a normal thing.
Between two plays that are unrelated. So there was like, there was, and when I first moved to New York sometime in the early 2000s, there was a two plays called House and Garden. And they ran in rep, but they were written together. Like they were written to run in rep, right?
Yeah. It wasn't just, oh God, we need to somehow make this work economically. Yeah. Let's just smash two shows into the same space.
Yeah, totally. Because we don't think we can drive ticket sales across eight shows a week for one play.
Mm-hmm. And that's interesting.
Jess, can you say, I think you said This Is a Play. It's This Is a Room.
Oh my gosh. This Is a Room. Sorry. And the play that goes wrong, I think I was getting things crosswired.
Wait, Jess, which of these two shows that are closing?
No, you can just put me saying I fucked it up and said it wrong. Thanks, Lucy.
Tie back to past either Clubhouse or podcast episode or both. We're about to find out if either of you remembers. We were talking about how to, like, the model of how Broadway shows work and the sort of inhospitable conditions that arise when you are doing eight shows a week and how... Is it worth it anymore? Oh, this actually might have been last week while you're out.
Oh.
We talked a ton about, like, is it no longer worth the sort of sacrifice to be in a Broadway show or sort of like the need to sacrifice your life to reach that level because you are, yeah, doing eight shows a week. And is that sustainable? And what are the options and opportunities to make that better for the cast and crew and the people who are working it? And one of the thoughts was just like having more people and having them switch nights and, you know, the stars, the cast, the crew, everyone is working half as much, but obviously like to double the number of talent and or crew is not economically viable given the current model for a Broadway show. But I hadn't thought about this idea of like having a show in there only half the time and how that works.
Right. And it all comes back to real estate again, right? I feel like every conversation we have about commercial theater somehow comes back to like the real estate part of the business.
I'm sure that there's other reasons why they don't, like, theaters don't do this switching on and off thing. There's probably extra expenses places. And at the end of the day, they're probably still just down to like each night, how many butts are in seats. Mm-hmm. But in effect, they have kind of doubled the cast and the crews.
Oh yeah, it's the same difference.
Just two shows.
Yeah.
Not necessarily.
You're not getting paid for eight shows a week, right?
Yeah.
You're doing four shows a week.
Yeah. I guess, is that not livable?
No, it's totally not, right? Because a pink contract, which is like the highest standardized contract in Actors Equity, is Ooh, I don't know what it is this year. $2,300 a week or something like that. Is that true? I think that's true. So like you could, that would mean you would be in effect if they kept everything the way it is on Broadway for $1,400 a week, you know, and you can't, like if you're lucky, you've got another show that's on the opposite schedule, I guess, to cobble the income together. But like, otherwise, if you're used to making $2,300 or whatever it is, and you are now living a life where you're doing $1,400, I guess you're getting a virtual assistant job also.
Oh, geez.
Yeah.
Wait, so that'd be $1,400 for 4 weeks a month across, I don't know, how many months are these things running? Like 4 or 5? What's like a run?
They're usually open-ended. So, you know, if it's a good show, months and months.
That's not a lot of money.
Mm-mm. No. But then again, I guess like if you don't want to work 8 shows a week, that's what you get, right?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It's super complicated because, you know, 8 shows a week is not actually, what is that? 4 hours a night times 8 performances. You're working a 32-hour week, which is, I think, actually the threshold, right? For full-time, quote unquote, like benefits and stuff at a lot of companies. You know, 8 shows a week is not crazy in terms of just like hours, but what it does require when you're an actor, right, is like my friend Kyle, who is a next to normal, like just can't go out, can't talk, can't drink, can't do anything because it's so taxing physically.
Yeah, it expands much more than just those 4 hours of the show.
Exactly.
It's all these other externalities of, yeah, the protecting your voice and having to work holidays and adjacent to those mm-hmm. holidays and not being able to travel because you have a show every single night.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's crunchy, this one. And we got to talk a lot about like, where do these shows that do come in come from? And I thought that, I don't know if you had at all, but I thought that was a really interesting, the development part of our conversation today was really, really interesting. But yeah. It's also something I spend a ton of time thinking and talking about, so mm-hmm. I could be biased.
Yeah. No, I love when the amazing, the brilliant Steph Cowan mm-hmm. joins the conversations because, again, her depth, like you were saying,
yeah.
in the development pipeline for shows and new works. And we got to talking in the conversation about how can you disincentivize profit-making as such an early metric of success for the early stages of the development pipeline,
mm-hmm.
Just because it needs time to develop, and a single failure shouldn't be a career-ending failure for a new artist or a new writer or a new whomever. And that was really interesting to me of like, how do you create? Because it has to be a protected space. You know, we live mm-hmm. in a capitalist society. Everything is, at the end of the day, tethered to its worth in terms of a dollar, whether it be our individual time or the success of a Broadway show. Like, everything kind of maps back to how much is it worth?
Mm-hmm.
So what sort of protected space could be made? And I would love, actually, if you could just repeat or kind of talk about how you bring up often this idea of taking some small percentage of profits, putting it into a fund of some sort, and just using that in a way to create a pool of money that doesn't need to make money back on it, but can just go out into the ether in some place,
mm-hmm.
And almost be like no strings attached in a way, because at the end of the day, we're acknowledging up front, like we need to create a space for this new work to be developed.
Yeah. Well, and something I'm going to start somewhere that I didn't actually mention in Clubhouse today, which is that like in film, so let's say film and theater are two industries where you need inbound creative IP to make a thing, right? In the film industry, you write a script. The end. Like filmmaking is filmmaking. Like you just need scripts. And to write a script, you need space. Do you know what I mean? Like a living room, like a quiet space, a room of one's own, right? The film industry is not as such that you need to make like a spec film. You need to do one scene and then you need to make a spec film. And then the series of actually producing it in order to get that big film made. Theater, for whatever reason, you know, probably too long of a discussion here, is not like that. It needs a script, but then it needs workshops and it needs development and it needs productions, like before it comes to Broadway. Your mention of space, right, becomes really important. And the thing about the development process in theater is just the second you make it profit motivated in such early stage, because as our friend Steph was saying, the development process is like, I don't average 6 to 8 years for a new musical. It's long, 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 long. Like if it's profit motivated, that means you have to like birth it perfect. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And like it, I don't, it's just doesn't work. So yeah, as you were mentioning earlier, like I was talking today about talking to a producer and suggesting to that producer that their fund maybe, right, needed to set aside some KPIs and metrics, some milestones to hit financially, and at which point they find a tax-friendly way, like something that can benefit them financially, to move some money over to a nonprofit-motivated donor-advised fund, whatever it is, to invest in the pipeline, you know, because particularly when we talk about diversity of the work that's coming into commercial theater, it's not. And that's because it's a real small group of people who get this shot, you know? And then they get recycled and recycled and recycled and recycled. They get a bunch of shots.
Let's give more shots to the people who already took them.
Yeah.
Just kidding. Let's not do that. It made me think, and I can't get his name out of my head, so I'm going to say it aloud and hopefully he'll go away. But across that conversation, I got thinking about Frederick Law Olmsted. I don't know if you're familiar with him. He's an architect, specifically a landscape architect that designed Central Park and Prospect Park and a number of other parks.
Yeah.
I read a book about him a couple of months ago at this point. And one of the themes throughout this book is like, has an idea, starts it, fails horribly. Has another idea, starts it, fails horribly. Has another idea, starts it, fails horribly. And like nested inside of that cycle is someone continuing to just give him money.
Right.
Like almost no strings attached money. And again, this is like the middle of the 1800s, yeah. Slightly different. But he is like of an ilk that you could just ask for unlimited money from banks or benefactors or whomever. And he just got to fail over and over and over and over and over again. And like at the end of the day, we get Central Park and Prospect Park, which I'm psyched about. They're great, great spaces inside of New York City. But yeah, what if his first farm that he started was a total, you know, was a failure, and then people were like, oh, okay, based on that, Frederick Law Olmsted.
Yeah, you're done.
You're done.
Right, because what Joe's referring to that I think we haven't actually said explicitly is that Steph brought up this thought of like female directors in the theater are frequently only given one chance to get a hit. And then if you don't, you never get another chance in the commercial theater. Whereas that is not necessarily the case she was positing for male directors, right? Who many of whom we all know that listen to this podcast, like get to just, I mean, they should, everyone should get to fail, right? So I just caught myself being snotty for almost snotty. And then I was like, don't be snotty, because we all want to fail. We all need the room to fail, but they get to fail and they keep getting hired, you know, and then they get that one big hit.
Yeah. And then everyone looks back and the story is of triumph and how resilient Frederick Law Olmsted is for continuing to have new ideas. And it's like, okay, true, right?
Yeah.
He didn't let it get him down. But like the underpinning of this is like someone continued to fund him.
Yeah.
And not everyone's getting that same chance.
Man, when she mentioned that got me hard. That because not that it's happened to me, but I feel that pressure that I think as a woman leader, I feel that like there's no wiggle room. There is no wiggle room to fail. We don't get a bunch of chances, you know, like we've been given so little to even succeed in the beginning, you know, and I'm sure I can't speak for this, but I'm sure it's true of communities of color and a lot of different marginalized communities, but you get so little accommodations, as our friend Jermaine said, and our colleague Jermaine said today in Clubhouse, so few accommodations for success in the first place that like, if you fuck up, they get taken away and you don't ever get anything else, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was thinking about the parallels between the tech industry and the theater world. In this way, where at least in the tech world, I feel like there's a bit more celebration of failure in a way that I don't know inside of the
talk about
the
that?
Theater world? Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. There is this idea that having a couple of skeleton companies in your closet, if you will, as a founder or a CEO is kind of a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
Like you've learned your mistakes. You know, it ties together with like the difficulty that first-time founders have raising money in the venture capital system. And even if your first company is, you know, an objective failure, it's still a company that you created and that you learned things through and that you have now experience bringing into your next phase. And I think that is part of like the ethos of entrepreneurship is like, fail and continue moving forward. Mm-hmm. And it is more celebrated, But what I wanted to get to with it is that I think it's celebrated in the same way that it is in theater, that it's celebrated for a certain subsect of those creators.
Right.
Where it's, right. You know, the archetypal Ivy League dropout.
Right.
Who is independently wealthy and can spend their whole life just working on projects and never taking a salary, et cetera, et cetera. And so that part feels extremely similar to right. the theater world. But at the very least, I appreciate that, like, there is a piece of the technology entrepreneurship culture that celebrates failure and mm-hmm. celebrates learning from that failure in a way that I don't see or don't know or don't recognize inside of the theater world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that subsect idea, because we were talking a lot about how the world of startups intersects with theater or doesn't intersect in this sort of conversation. And we were talking about this idea of investing in people, not products or ideas. And that Steph, our producer friend, it's actually the first time I've heard a theater person say that, by the way. I've never heard that from a theater person. And she said, as a producer, particularly of new work, I really want to invest in people and teams and not necessarily the show, the single show. And I was like, my comment was, oh, that's funny. That's peddled like crazy in startup land. And like, we've had not a small amount of meetings with venture, firms. And I really got thinking a lot today about like how I found that not to be true in practice throughout our conversations, except for like we happen to meet one investor who seems to like really actually embody that. But it like, I was thinking just a lot about the way in which it triggers like my feeling I can never do enough. Like I can never do enough right to even for anyone to fucking care or matter. Do you know what I mean? Which is like a thing from like, I was just like always in trouble as a kid and like in a dance studio that was merciless about like perfection and all that shit. But like then you read this idea, right? And you're like, oh, I invest in people. That's me. Like you and I have like track records and a history of incredible work behind us, groundbreaking thoughts. Like I think we're pretty fun to hang out with. You know what I mean? Like all of those things. And then to walk into all those meetings and be like, this is only true for a subsect. Mm-hmm. I yet like again am left with what do I have to do for someone to give me accommodations?
Yeah, this phrase, I invest in people and teams, needs to have a big old asterisk next to it.
Yeah.
So it's like, if you are or have proven success, if you are or have a technology product that's already built with a million, like,
right.
There's all these things.
Caveats.
That go with that. But that asterisk sort of undermines the cleanliness of the story and the meritocracy that comes with, you know, we just invest in good people, hardworking people, smart people. That's all you have to be. That's it. It's easy. But it's a story that we tell ourselves that, oh my God, it's very American dream-esque.
Mm.
It's like it's part of what almost tricks people into continue grinding. Because now, totally. Again, similar parallels to the New Work development pipeline. It's like a startup company starts up by someone just devoting all their time, energy, and mental resources to creating this thing.
The same.
And then once it's like built up to some capacity where they can start showing it to people, then there's the opportunity for potential investment. But it requires that human to grind away for an infinite amount of time in theory at the prospect of success.
Right.
No guarantee, obviously.
No, for sure.
And it's you need a little bit of mythos inside of that to believe and to justify spending that time.
You mean like being able to see something down the corridor?
There needs to be some hero's journey set out in front of you.
Yeah.
Where it is possible for you to succeed, even if that archetypal journey is like just not at all real.
Mm-hmm.
And if you were to map it out, it's littered with other like pitfalls and fallacies and all these things. But we have to continue to tell ourselves and each other the same made up story. Because if the story around entrepreneurship and startup culture was like, oh, you're never going to succeed. Just don't even don't waste your time. Like, just go work for Facebook. Just go work for Google. Just go work for a bank. Just become an accountant. Just become a lawyer. Like, don't even try. Which is like, I think, a fair story to be told.
Yeah, totally.
Then you would lose that pipeline of people who are coming out of Stanford coding shit in their Palo Alto garage.
That just totally reminds me. In theater, like frequently when you go back to talk to kids in college or, you know, we heard it. The line is, if you like doing anything else, don't do theater. Literally, if you could enjoy doing anything else, just forget it. Like, walk away now.
Wow, that's real. I appreciate that a lot.
Yeah,
like, that's true. If you're not ready to sacrifice literally everything.
Yeah, we're real realists about the bullshit of our industry and our profession.
All right. Well, that's amongst the first times on this podcast, I feel like I'm like, that's a really great thing that is built into the,
so
the way
true.
The theater currently works.
We did it. We found one. Yeah,
just like radical transparency about how trash it could be for you.
Oh, my God. Well, so to continue as we like wrap up our hello and welcome to any new listeners that have joined us. We really do love theater, and that's why we have these conversations, because I think we're at a moment in time and technology and startups, like as frustrating as that process can be too, right? We still really believe in the opportunity and promise and the change that can come from these two systems. So that's why we spend 2 hours on Tuesdays just like talking about it and talking about it and talking about it. So I promise we care a lot. And I actually wanted to open the invitation. If you listen to this podcast and you're having conversations about these topics, like in your institution or with your friends or your collaborators, like reach out, say hi on Twitter, join Clubhouse. But we'd love to know you and to meet you and maybe even have you on the podcast, because, yeah, having these conversations with smart people is like one of our favorite things.
It's the best. So join the conversation with us on Twitter. You can tweet at us. We are at BWY Unlocked, and use the hashtag TechTheaterCH to share your thoughts.
And of course, to be a part of our next conversation, Tuesday at 12:55 Eastern on Clubhouse. Be sure to raise your hand, jump in, let us know you listen to the podcast, and get into the conversation with us.
And if you enjoyed today's episode, we would love it if you could rate us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts. Leave that review.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5. We should have a song about 5-star reviews. Well, at any rate, every single topic we talk about each week is inspired by the articles we read and drop in our company Slack, as well as the people who join our stage. So please tweet us at hashtag TechTheaterCH, like Joe said. Say hi and join in the conversation. But until then, we'll see you next week.
Bye, everyone.
Bye. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5-star review. You give us a 5-star review. It's a review for us that is 5 stars.